something really special?
When we achieved it, well, first of all, it started before we became famous, because we kept saying, well, why don't they see how great we are? You know, because mm-hmm. we were called the no-hit Supremes, mm-hmm. which I wrote that, okay? I coined that phrase, but now it's in a... Ooh. So you know, I coined that because, you know, we couldn't get that hit record, and that was what was going to put us over the top, right? Mm-hmm. So... once we realized that's what we had to have, then our dream changed from just being singers. It changed to wanting to achieve something special. And so that was our goal. And once that happened, once Mr. Berry Gordy put us together with Harland Osher Holland, and we got the hit records, that was when we knew we had achieved it. When we were on the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars tour, and they had released Where Did Our Love Go?, and the record became a hit while we were on the tour. We didn't even know it because we're on this bus tour traveling the South, you know, with people like the Drifters, the Shirelles, and Gene Pitney, and Leslie Gore. We were on that kind of tour. So when the record became a hit and we were on this bus tour, we kind of like, you know, we knew we had made it. That's when we knew we had made that we had achieved what we wanted to.
Tell us about that friendly competition. I assume it's friendly competition. Mary Wells, Kim Weston, Martha, Vandellas, Marvelettes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you say tell you about the friendly competition. I don't think that any one of us felt that we were competing against each other. And I tell you why that's so important for people to understand that. You would think with all of these wonderful talented people, there would be competition. But as you did say, it was friendly, but we didn't think of it as competition. Okay. You know, I remember just being in awe of people. We were there when Stevie Wonder came in. Mr. Gordy, Berry Gordy said, we have a little genius coming in today, and I want you girls, you Supremes, to be here when he comes in. And I'm saying to myself, what is a genius? I don't know if I've ever seen a genius before. Once Stevie came in, I'm like, that's a genius. He played every instrument there. But that's the way everyone was. So we were admired each other for the talent. Now, when one person got a hit record, then, you know, you start to say, okay, when is mine coming? That's when maybe some sort of whatever. But it was always lovingly done that you know, we did the tours. Whoever, say, if the Contours opened, whoever followed the Contours would come off the stage saying, okay, beat that. And then the next one would come off and say, beat that. But it was all really a wonderful feeling. It made everyone even better.
Co-founder of the legendary Supremes. Wilson died on February 8, 2021. She was 76.
Thor, the Metal Avenger. You are listening to the music of the gods with Sean Watson on WRCT, Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Behold the hammer!
Oh, WRCT Pittsburgh.
Support comes from Austin Water. There's a grease blob wreaking havoc in Austin, causing clogged pipes and backed up sewers. Residents can help by not pouring oil and grease in the sink. Instead, pouring it in a can and then in the trash. Learn more at austinwater.org.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I didn't know enough to write about their lives as musicians and tell people something new about these three men that everybody has heard. But what I was trying to do was write a book about their lives off the bandstand and basically say that these guys, in addition to leaving an amazing musical legacy, they helped write the soundtrack for and set the table for the Civil Rights Revolution. As Martin Luther King recognized in a little recognized speech that he delivered in the early 1960s, he said, if it wasn't for these jazz men opening America's ears and souls to the potential of black genius, that what he did in terms of integrating schools and other things might never have happened.
Larry Tye, historian, former reporter with the Boston Globe, and author of The Jazzmen, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America, published by Mariner Books. Born within a few years of one another, they overcame racial exclusion and violence to become the most popular entertainers on the planet. Based on more than 250 interviews, this extensively researched book brings alive the history of Black America in the early to mid-1900s through the singular lens of the country's most gifted, engaging, and enduring African-American musicians. This story also traces the development of different styles of jazz in the city where they got their start. Kansas City for Count Basie, New York City for Duke Ellington, and New Orleans and Chicago for Louis Armstrong. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, The Jazzmen, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transform America, with author Larry Tye, In Black America.
What I think they did was, in white households where the racist head of the household would never have let a black man cross their threshold, they wooed, these same racist white men wooed their sweethearts with the music of the gravel-throated Satchmo Armstrong and with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. White women who, if they saw a black man coming towards them on a sidewalk, would have walked to the other side of the street. When they were in their own living room, they kicked off their high heels and danced to the toe-tapping music of the Count Basie Orchestra. For once, when they were listening to these three guys, race fell away as an issue, and America just wanted to listen. And people became convinced, first, of their genius, second, of their humanity, and I think that hope opened people's ears to the idea that maybe these guys actually deserved equal rights.
Larry Tye's The Jazzmen opened a new window into the lives of three iconic jazz musicians, revealing so much more about their musical journey and personal experiences off the bandstand. What is far less known about these groundbreakers is that they were bound not by just their music or even the discrimination that they, like nearly all African-American performers of their day, routinely encountered. These three titans of jazz defied and ultimately overcame racial boundaries by opening America's eyes and souls to the magnificence of their music. In the process, they wrote the soundtrack for the Civil Rights Movement. They took their songs into the white households that would not let a black man through the front door. Recently in Black America spoke with Larry Tye. All of your previous books have dealt with different subjects, but this one deals with musicians. Why so?
Because 20 years ago, I wrote a book about the black men who worked on the railroad called Pullman Porters. And when I was writing that book, there were 40 Pullman porters alive. By the time the book came out a year and a half later, there were only 20, and today there are none, which makes me take even more seriously the promise that I made to them that I would someday write a book about their three favorite passengers, three guys named Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie. And the reason they were their favorite passengers says a lot, I think, about the porters, about the jazzmen, and about America. And in that era, even if you were the leading musicians in the world, like Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie, when you went below the Mason-Dixon line, you were putting yourself at risk. If you went into the wrong restaurant trying to get lunch, or tried to check into the wrong hotel, and it was a whites-only restaurant or hotel, you could be subject to berating or beating or much worse. And so what these guys did when they went south was they rented private Pullman sleeping cars. They pulled them off in a city like Atlanta when they were doing a concert, and after their concert at night, they knew they had a safe place to get a great meal, to have a plush bed waiting for them, and to have guys like the Pullman porters greeting them like they were heroes. And what they did in return, in the middle of the night, in that closed capsule of a railroad car, they would perform private concerts for the Pullman porters. And I don't know about you, John, but if I could go back in any moment in history, it would be to those railroad cars to have the Duke Ellington band performing all night just for me.
I understand. 200 and something interviews, and you said you weren't going to write the 101st biography of these individuals. Why so?
Because I didn't know enough to write about their lives as musicians and tell people something new about these three men that everybody has heard. But what I was trying to do was write a book about their lives off the bandstand and basically say that these guys, in addition to leaving an amazing musical legacy, they helped write the soundtrack for and set the table for the Civil Rights Revolution. As Martin Luther King recognized in a little recognized speech that he delivered in the early 1960s, he said, if it wasn't for these jazzmen opening America's ears and souls to the that it was called the battlefield. And what kept him alive was at age 13 ending up in reform school, being plucked off the streets by a police detective who sent him to reform school. And that is where Louis Armstrong learned to play the bugle and then the cornet and then a trumpet. And it is what he said let him stay alive when so many of his young friends who he hung out with in the streets didn't manage to survive.
Now, what was revealed when you wrote the book about jazz music in this country?
It was the most all-American of our music forms. It came from everything from gospel music in churches to the blues to generally the experience of the musicians who were playing it. And it was, as Duke Ellington told us, he wanted to rename jazz Negro music because he felt this was a music that told the story of blacks in America. And he used his compositions to tell that story. And what I realized about jazz was it was a whole lot more than about music. It was about life in America and about black life in America.
When you were writing the stories, you intertwine all their lives together. How'd you go about putting that particular concept together?
Well, it was partly that they were born within 5 years of one another at the turn of the last century. It was partly that they were amazing musicians who, in different ways, expanded the genre of jazz to make it much more inclusive and much more resonant. And it was most of all that they all survived for 50 long years at the top of their profession, and they all did a whole lot more than just play music.
Now, when you decided to take on this particular project, was there anything surprising that you learned that you probably wouldn't want to know?
So that I wouldn't want to know, not so much, except that all of these three men were men of faith. They believed in God, they prayed before every meal, and they read the Bible. Duke Ellington said he read it cover to cover three times. But what I learned was that they violated regularly lots of the Ten Commandments. And the one that they most violated was the notion of being faithful to their wives. Louis Armstrong was married four times, and even with his fourth and longest-lasting wife, he regularly cheated on her in a way that he admitted and that she knew. Count Basie was only married twice, but he was unfaithful enough to his wife that several times she left him and only came back when he pleaded. And Duke Ellington stayed married to the same woman all of his life, but he really only lived with her as her husband for 3 or 4 years, and he stayed married to her because he had so many mistresses that it gave him an excuse. When they said, "Marry me," he could say, "I'm already married. You don't want me to go through an expensive divorce."
Talk to us about how Duke Ellington gave himself the moniker Duke.
When he was a kid, and they lived in a really nice house in Washington, he would every morning walk down the steep staircase of the house, and he would tell his young nephews who were at the bottom of the steps waiting for him, "You should bow to me." He would tell his young nieces, "You should curtsy." And he would tell everybody, "Applaud, applaud, because someday I'm going to be known as the great and the grand Duke Ellington." And he made up all kinds of interesting stories over the years of where that name came from. But the one I believe most is the one that he gave himself the name, because he had a sense that he was going to be worthy of an aristocratic title, and he was worthy of that in every way.
Also, talk to us about William Jane Count Basie, how he gave himself the name Count.
He told even more stories than Duke did about where that name came from, but he gave it to himself. He actually printed up business cards. He decided if Duke Ellington could be a Duke, and if King Oliver, the great band leader who helped launch Louis Armstrong, if King Oliver could be a king, then he, Willie Basie, was worthy of being a count. He printed up the business cards, he called himself Count, and that stuck.
Before Louis Armstrong settled on the trumpet, there were other instruments he tried to play. Talk to us about that.
Sure. He tried to play in reform school, he tried to play the bugle, he tried to play in the streets of New Orleans the cornet, but the instrument that he proved to the world he could make sing in a way that nobody ever had was the trumpet, and that's the one that stuck.
When you started on this journey, how long has it been since you first had the idea to the publication of the book?
So from the moment one when I had the idea to the moment when the book came out, which was just recently, it was exactly 4 years. I worked on the book itself for 3 long and fun years.
I understand. You're listening to In Black America with John L. Hanson, Jr. We'll be back with more of our conversation in just a moment.
Support comes from Austin Water. There's a grease blob wreaking havoc in Austin, causing clogged pipes and backed up sewers. Residents can help by not pouring oil and grease in the sink, instead pouring it in a can and then in the trash. Learn more at austinwater.org.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with Larry Tye, former reporter at the Boston Globe, former journalism professor, and author of The Jazzman, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. Mr. Tye, talk to us about how their music helped usher in the civil rights movement?
So what I think they did was, in white households where the racist head of the household would never have let a black man cross their threshold, they wooed, these same racist white men wooed their sweethearts with the music of the gravel-throated Satchmo Armstrong and with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. White women who, if they saw a black man coming towards them on a sidewalk, would have walked to the other side of the street. When they were in their own living room, they kicked off their high heels and danced to the toe-tapping music of the Count Basie Orchestra. For once, when they were listening to these three guys, race fell away as an issue, and America just wanted to listen. And people became convinced, first, of their genius, second, of their humanity. And I think that hope opened people's ears to the idea that maybe these guys actually deserved equal rights.
How did their association with the underworld assist them in becoming who they became?
John, if we remember back to the jazz era, that was also the era of prohibition, when the sale of alcohol was banned. And what mobsters did, guys like Al Capone and Dutch Schultz, they opened speakeasies where they could sell under the table for a whole lot of money liquor that they had bootlegged and that they were selling illegally. And they needed to attract people to come to their speakeasies. And the best way to do it was to have this new form of music, jazz, performed in their clubs. So they gave jazzmen like Ellington Armstrong and Basie money to support themselves, and in return, these jazzmen gave them crowds to buy their bootleg liquor, and it was a perfect partnership of the mobsters and the jazzsters.
Count Basie hung out in Kansas City. Talk to us about his tenure in that city.
So he played in a dive bar called the Reno Club,
mm-hmm.
and he was a little bit of a derelict in those days. His wife divorced him because he got drunk so often, but in this dive bar, they had a microphone, and the microphone had a radio hookup, and the radio hookup went, among other places, to New York, and a jazz promoter named John Hammond heard Count Basie when he was riding around in his car in New York. And the next day, John Hammond got on a plane to Kansas City, flew in, and signed up Count Basie, and Count Basie took off. And he brought with him this whole new style of music called Kansas City Swing.
Also, Duke Ellington, he had a radio program in the Cotton Club, correct?
He did. So the Cotton Club was the hottest club in Harlem. It was sadly done on a plantation motif, but this is where Duke Ellington knew he was going to make his name. And it was the first black music that whites across America had ever heard because of that radio hookup. And when whites who were living in Iowa and Kansas and the sticks all across America got to New York, the first thing they wanted to do was go hear this guy, Duke Ellington, at the Cotton Club.
Talk to us about Ellington finally settling on the piano.
So Ellington was... had lots of ways he could have made a living. He was offered a scholarship at an arts institute
right.
in New York.
Mm-hmm.
He turned it down. He could have been a painter. He turned it down. And what he decided was that the piano and making music was what was going to be his thing. And he became a composer of more than 6,000 songs. He became a brilliant arranger. He could play the piano better than just about anybody. And most of all, he was known as being a band leader of the great Duke Ellington Orchestra.
Were there some parts of their biographies you had to leave, per se, on the cutting floor?
I did. I had more than 8,000 pages of notes. I wrote enough. I did enough interviews to have written three separate biographies, so I had to leave out two-thirds of each of their biography in order to get in the third that would make it into the book. That was the bad news. The good news was what that meant for the reader was hopefully I picked only the best stuff, and so instead of having the best 10% make it into the book, the best 1% of my research made it in.
How did you go about organizing the chapters?
With great painstaking care. It was, when you're working your way through 8,200 pages of notes, it's difficult, but it was so much fun that it almost wrote itself. Can you imagine, John, being able to call it work for 3 years, getting to listen to the music of Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie?
Now, when you finally decided on the structure of your work, what was the main thing that you were trying, other than showing what was life like outside of them performing music?
So I wanted to show, a week or so ago, the world celebrated the 70th anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education decision integrating America's schools, maybe the most important Supreme Court decision ever. And I wanted to show, with Brown versus Board and lots of momentous things in American race history like that, that we don't get there in a straight line. I learned in my fifth grade civics class that Brown versus Board was a natural growth from Plessy versus Ferguson to all kinds of other court decisions. But as Martin Luther King said, we don't get to those court decisions in a straight line. We get there with things like jazz opening up America's consciousness to the idea that something else was going on in this country. It's the same way when I wrote a book about the wonderful baseball pitcher Satchel Paige. He helped set the table for civil rights revolutions the same way these jazzmen did.
Do you think these three individuals have gotten their just due thus far?
No, they got their just due as musicians, but not as revolutionaries. They were quiet subversives, and that's a story they didn't often tell, and it's a story that I think America should and hopefully will want to hear.
In reading the last couple of chapters, I understand that Louis Armstrong basically was writing his memoirs to make sure the records were straight.
Exactly. He wrote three separate memoirs because he didn't trust people like me to get it right. So he wanted to make sure that he got it right.
When you looked at their lives and the times in which they were living, what particularly surprised you about how they navigated the system?
I want to just tell you one quick story that answers that question. It's the story of when Duke Ellington was in Lynchburg, Virginia, performing. And he couldn't find a hotel that would take him as a black man. And finally, his manager talked the owner of a whites-only hotel to accept Ellington for the night. And the manager said, the manager of the hotel said, you're going to have to pay an extra fee for pillowcases and sheets. And Ellington's guy said, what do you mean, a separate fee? And the hotel guy said, that's because when a black man has slept in this bed, we're going to have to burn the sheets and pillowcases. And what surprised me is this level of indignity and affront, even with the famous Duke Ellington. You know, we knew there was racism in the country, but the idea that Louis Armstrong would be a headliner in a nightclub in Las Vegas, but could only get in through the kitchen, that just shocked me.
Talk to us about the managers they worked with during their tenure.
So they all three had, at one point or another, Jewish managers. And it's because I think Jews and blacks, shared stories, loving storytelling. They shared a love of music and of jazz, and they shared an outsider status. And so Armstrong, Ellington, and Basie all recognized that on the one hand, they needed a white man to represent them because they could get better deals for them, and that the white men who would be most sensitive to their story were Jewish white men. And this was part of the famous Black-Jewish alliance of the last century.
Did all three have signature songs?
They did. So we know in the end, they all started with one signature song and ended with another. With Duke Ellington, he started with and never quite gave up on Take the A Train, the famous song written by Billy Strayhorn. And he ended up, my favorite signature song of his was one that was attacking the racist chief of police named Bull Connor in Birmingham, Alabama. And it was a song that Ellington wrote called King Fit the Battle of Alabama. The signature song of Count Basie that he started out with was the toe-tapping tune called 1 o'clock Jump. But he ended up with a song that the Apollo astronauts took to the moon, which was appropriately called Fly Me to the Moon. And with Louis Armstrong, his signature song was a song from his home state of Louisiana called When It's Sleepy Time Down South. But the song that ended up as his best-known song was one that sold 3 million copies, and that at age 63, he knocked the Beatles from number one on the Billboard charts with a song called Hello, Dolly.
How did they balance their artistry with being entertainers?
So they did it in their own way. They didn't think there was a contradiction in being an artist and an entertainer, and they might have had to do a little bit of hamming up on the stage, especially when they were playing before white audiences, but they never sacrificed their dignity, and they thought they could do it their way, and they lasted for 50 years doing it their way.
Having researched the three, who do you believe made the biggest impact on American music?
So as much as Count Basie was the consummate band leader, and as much as Duke Ellington did everything from writing to playing music, the one who made the biggest impact on the world, I think, was Louis Armstrong. It used to be said in the 1950s and 60s, the two most recognizable Americans anywhere in the world were Mickey Mouse and Louis Armstrong, and I believe it.
What do you want readers to come away with once they read your work?
I want them to see that these guys were a lot more than just musicians, and I want them to see that racial change happened in unexpected and strange ways, as Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie showed us.
Were there any particular cities that they played were more acceptance of them being there?
Nowhere was totally accepting. Even in New York, they faced racism. And all three of them traveled the country, including where you are now in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And all three of them got huge audiences to come out anywhere they played, but they also got racists to come out anywhere they played.
You write in the book about territory bands. Talk to us about that a little.
So those were the bands that went to places like Louisiana and Kansas and Texas, and they all had certain territories that they specialized in, and those were bands that took their music, jazz, to places that had never heard it before, and took their black faces to places that had never seen blacks before, and I think they were extraordinary ambassadors for their race, and then when they traveled around the world, for their country.
Talk to us a little bit about the jobs that they held before they became infamous and famous.
They held jobs anywhere they could, making nickels and dimes and never being paid what they deserved, even in their heyday, never being paid what the famous white bands did. But they needed to support their families, and they took jobs doing anything they could do. And they played for 300 of 365 days out of the year for most of their lives.
Larry Tye, author of The Jazzmen, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard,
Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
In Black America and KUT Public Radio are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows on the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
We sat down in my living room, my mother's living room, and he talked about my plans. He kind of opened the conversation, what are your plans now? As if I had thought about it. And I told him, I ain't got no plans. What are you talking about? I didn't do that in an aggressive fashion. It's just that I had never planned anything at that point, except maybe a defensive tactic when I was in high school. And my mother had, in her conversation back and forth with him, had got him to reveal the fact that he was a coach at the University of Texas. And I had been to Austin one time, and I was following my brother to chase girls. I was too young to catch any, but my brother had a good time up here. But he mentioned Austin, and I said, okay. And my mother at some point in that conversation brought me inside, and he told me who he was. And I really didn't have any thoughts about any other schools after that.
The late Julius Whittier, the first African-American football scholarship recipient and letterman at the University of Texas at Austin. Whittier was a member of a team that won three straight Southwest Conference championships. In 1969, he was recruited by UT from Highland High School in San Antonio, Texas, where he was the team captain. He was a standout on the Longhorn freshman team. He joined the varsity squad in 1970, one season after Texas fielded the last all-white national championship team in the history of college football. He starred for two seasons at offensive tackle, switching to tight end as a senior in 1972. Whittier went on to earn a bachelor's degree in philosophy, a master's from the LBJ School of Public Affairs, encouraged by the late President Lyndon Johnson, and a law degree at UT. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America and the beginning of our 54th season. On this week's program, the life and legacy of Julius Whittier in Black America.
Yeah, we hear my mother and father discussing it, and of course they had their fears just based on the racial climate, not only at UT, but in America in general. They had those fears that he might get injured or hurt or even killed. But in the end, they left that decision up to him. He was being recruited by a number of schools, but Julius was in love with the state of Texas and just had no intention of going anywhere other than a school here in Texas. And I think the success that UT was experiencing, in particular in the football arena, piqued his interest. And that's pretty much where he settled in terms of his next move for college.
Mildred Whittier, the sister of the late Julius Whittier. Without Julius Whittier, there's no Roosevelt League. There's no Earl Campbell, no Ricky Williams, no Vince Young, and no 2005 national championship. In 1963, UT dropped his ban on African-American players, but integration was slow. A few African-American players joined the Longhorns, but none stayed long enough to make the varsity squad in an era where freshmen were ineligible to play under NCAA rules. When Julius Whittier arrived on campus at the University of Texas at Austin in the fall of 1969, as one of the first African-American student-athletes to receive a scholarship from Texas, he was one of just 300 African-American students on campus. Born on July 7th, 1950 in San Antonio, Texas, Whittier was just 5'10", 193 pounds when UT came calling. He has been inducted into the Longhorn Hall of Honor, the San Antonio Sports Hall of Fame, and a bronze statue of his likeness stands outside DK Royal Texas Memorial Stadium. In the spring of 2015, KUT Jennifer Staten spoke with Whittier.
Mike Campbell recruited you to come play
at
UT.
That was Iron Mike, right? Iron Mike.
All right, right. So tell us what year this was and what that recruiting process was like in being recruited and deciding to come to UT.
It was a very, very abrupt recruiting process because when Mike Campbell showed up at my house in San Antonio, knocking on the door, so to speak, I was totally oblivious to anything outside of San Antonio. I've recently understood my manner to be that I was ADD, and all I knew was what was going on right now, and the only town I knew about was San Antonio, and it gave a lot of opportunities for, what do you call it, curious kids, and it was a time in San Antonio when kids could go up and down downtown without parental supervision and get home safely without any hassles. And things have changed significantly in modern American life since then, but that's the times that I grew up in San Antonio. 1969 was my last year living in San Antonio. And since then, I'm sure things have changed, but it's still a beautiful town.
But something then got you, something convinced you to come from San Antonio then to Austin. What was it that got you to leave San Antonio then to come to UT?
One thing I knew for certain, by the time our recruiters got down there, Mike Campbell, Iron Mike they call him, I call him that too because he was pretty hard-nosed and he was an excellent defensive coordinator. But he came knocking on our door. And he asked Mom if he might have a conversation with me about the University of Texas. And I think she knew. She was trying to play like she didn't know that he was coming because he wanted to schedule a time when at least one of my parents was available. And my mom was a school teacher, and so she got off in time for an afternoon conversation about what he wanted to talk about. And I didn't know. I didn't know what the hell he was there for. But it was after my senior season at Highlands High School, and I was gloriously named to the all-city team at the time. And we sat down in my living room, my mother's living room, and he talked about my plans. He kind of opened the conversation, what are your plans now, as if I had thought about it. And I told him, I ain't got no plans. What are you talking about? I didn't do that in an aggressive fashion. It's just that I had never planned anything at that point except maybe a defensive tactic when I was in high school. My mother had, in her conversation back and forth with him, had got him to reveal the fact that he was a coach at the University of Texas. And I had been to Austin one time, and I was following my brother to chase girls. I was too young to catch any, but my brother had a good time up here. But he mentioned Austin, and I said, okay. And my mother at some point in that conversation brought me inside, and he told me who he was. And I really didn't have any thoughts about any other schools after that.
Well, so you came to Texas, played for Coach Royal. Tell us your thoughts, your memories about Coach Royal.
Coach Royal was a second daddy, and I say that sincerely. Coach Royal had a way of making clear what he expected of all of us. He knew that he was stepping out on a limb by recruiting me, and I think that he was fairly courageous in, you know, taking that step, because at that time we were an all-white team. And that had really no impact on me, since I had gone to integrated schools in San Antonio from elementary through high school. and all the public facilities were available. Of course, one of my favorite was the Alamo. We'd walk down the Alamo and wander around it for 2 hours every couple of months, and that was a lot of fun. Coach Royal sent his best man, Coach Campbell, and he was kind of, like I say, he was called Iron Mike, and talked to me about the university, if I had any plans. I told him no, I hadn't thought about anything but what's going to happen tonight. And because I was, like I said, that attention deficit means that I'm just paying attention to what's in front of me. And I think I came into the room with my shoes off and my shirt tail out and not knowing who this man was.
Well, you must have made a good impression, though.
Well, I think it was the fact that I was an all-city linebacker.
That probably didn't.
In the San Antonio Express and News. And I'd like I said, I hadn't expected to do anything except maybe go, you know, stock grocery stores or something. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, I know your time is short, so I just want to ask one more question about Coach Royal. You said he went out on a limb for you. He was like a second daddy, and he... that he had a way of getting his point across and making sure everybody understood what he wanted. What was his style like? How did he make those points and get his point across, whether it's getting the players to do what he needs them to do or conveying his care and concern in a fatherly way? What was his style with you all like?
I think Coach Royal, and I have some evidence of that, of my memories of being around him, that he went out of his way to surveil my comfort and such that he might coax out the best of my athletic skills. And I didn't mind that, and I liked it, as a matter of fact, because I could be showing a recruit around and he being there with, you know, somebody planning a Bros Bowl or, you know, big happenings. And he would ask, you know, have us step to the receptionist, and she'd tell us, no, you can't go in now, but I got a pass. So I'd stick my head in, hey, Coach Royal, this is so-and-so from Killeen, and he wants to play football at DT, and he's thinking about it, and I'll let you know the results. You know, I'd give him an update, and he'd smile and laugh at some different times. And so that was one little itty-bitty privilege I had with Coach Royal during recruiting season.
I'm just curious, final question then. When was the last time you spoke with him or had interaction with him over the years?
The last time I had contact with Coach Royal was really hard. I had to see him seated in a chair, unlike his normal self, you know, unable to walk around. And he passed the way my mother passed. With Alzheimer's, and it hurt me. They were part of a generation of people who basically were the backbone of this country. And they all made a difference. He made a difference in the access to black football players playing at a top-notch university. And there were alumni and there were regents. I don't know who they were, but I do know for a fact there were alumni and regents who did not want black kids on this campus. And Coach Royal bucked that. And that's one of the things I admire about him, is he was a man with his own independent image of what's right and what's wrong. And I had a great time at UT. I got disciplined at the right times because I was into stuff. And being under Coach Royal's eyeball, I needed to watch what the hell I was doing. If I wanted to stay on the team, if I wanted to get a degree and so forth. But that knock on the door by Iron Mike began my love for the University of Texas. And I got 3 degrees from university, and it was one of the best walks of my life.
Well, thank you for your time.
Yeah, Coach Royal will be missed.
There was a he was a mountain of a man, even though he was just as tall as I was, but he had a big view of the world, and I was glad to be a part of his program.
The late Julius Whittier. Whittier paved the way for some of the best football players in program history to walk onto campus without fear of prejudice, bigotry, or mistreatment because of the color of their skin. Whittier died on September 24, 2018. He was 68. You're listening to In Black America with Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. We'll be back in just a moment.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. On today's program, we're spotlighting the life and legacy of Julius Whittier, the first African-American athlete to receive a scholarship to the University of Texas at Austin. Whittier earned an undergraduate degree in philosophy, a master's from the LBJ School of Public Affairs, and a law degree from Texas. He went on to be a criminal prosecutor in Dallas, Texas. Recently in Black America spoke with his sister, Mildred. Julius was just inducted into, I guess, the San Antonio Hall of Honor or Hall of Fame. What was it?
San Antonio Sports Hall of Fame, the 2024 inductees.
Talk to us about Julius as a, are you the younger or older sister of Julius? I guess that's the first question.
I'm the baby of four. Two boys and two girls, yes. Julius and I are next to each other.
Prior to him attending the Highland High School, what kind of brother was he?
Annoying. He was annoying but fun. He was basically a prankster. He did all kinds of things to annoy us, and especially when we were asleep. He liked to put pepper in our mouth when we were asleep, which would wake us up in a furor, but he was different. He was definitely, he bucked the system, which included my mother, but he rarely bucked my dad because my dad didn't play. But he was the character in our family.
Were you there when Coach Campbell came to offer Julius a scholarship to the University of Texas?
More than likely I was, but I do not remember.
Did Julius talk to you about any of his experiences while he was attending UT?
Rarely, other than he had a lot of fun. UT was his playground. And football was his avenue to expand his thinking, explore whatever the university had to offer. So football gave him that gateway.
So did your parents ever talk to, I guess, the family about Julius attending and some of the things he may have to experience while he was there being one of the first African-American athletes at the university?
Yeah, we hear my mother and father discussing it. And, of course, they had their fears just based on the racial climate, not only at UT, but in America in general. They had those fears that he might get injured or hurt or even killed. But in the end, they left that decision up to him. He was being recruited by a number of schools, but Julius was in love with the state of Texas and just had no intention of going anywhere other than a school here in Texas. And I think the success that UT was experiencing, in particular in the football arena, piqued his interest. And that's pretty much where he settled in terms of his next move for college.
Were you surprised with the interest that people had of your brother?
No, because, I mean, all of that just didn't interest me, to be honest.
Okay.
You know, it was his life, and he loved playing football. So, you know, I guess I was a little naive at the time in terms of all of the racial issues that existed. So, you know, we never really had any discussions, any deep discussions about, you know, are you sure this is what you want to do, blah, blah, blah. So, no, I really was not a part of that decision. I was just the little sister on the side following whatever decision he made.
Now, understand that once Julius earned his philosophy degree here at UT. He went to Boston to work in the mayor's office?
Actually, it was, yeah, he worked for, that was in 19, when did I finish college? 75, I think it was, seven. It might have been 76 to 77 or 78. But yeah, he worked for the mayor. I think it was White was the mayor at the time in Boston. And I had already started working and living in Boston at the time, so we were roommates for a year.
Was it interesting having your brother there with you?
It was a pain, to be honest. I love my brother to death, but I was like his other mother on his case about everything, you know. And he admitted that I was quite annoying, but it did enable him to develop some very good habits.
I understand that the late President Lyndon Johnson was instrumental in Julius attending the LBJ school in his inaugural class.
Yes, and I guess it dates back to Julius's time playing football, and LBJ and Coach Royal were buddies, friends, so he got his degree in public affairs.
I'm making an assumption that in these gatherings, Julius was probably the only African-American that
yeah,
was there.
Yeah, because he was the only African-American there for a while until they started recruiting, or actually using Julius to help recruit some other African-Americans. So at that time, he was the only African-American.
What made Julius consider becoming an attorney? Do you know?
I don't have a clue, other than Julius, he was the kind that, he was a very deep thinker, number one. And I'm thinking law might have been the bridge between his public affairs degree and the real world. But he never expressed to me why, but I never asked. But that's what I would conclude, just based on his public affairs experience.
Now, once out of law school, did he immediately go work for the district attorney's office in Dallas County?
No, he worked for an attorney in Austin, I think, for a year, and I can't remember what his name was, but he spent a year or so in Austin and then got an offer from Henry Wade in Dallas County, and that's when he made that transition.
During Julius' tenure at UT, were there any trepidations that he had once he accepted the scholarship and knowing that he will be one of only a small number of African-Americans, one on campus, but secondly in the athletic department?
No, that, to my knowledge, that never bogged him down, because Julius's focus on UT honestly was bigger than football. He saw UT as a tremendous resource or a tremendous avenue to explore many, many, many resources. UT had everything, and Julius tried to partake of it in terms of his academics, the exposure that he would get. He just saw it as his playground, honestly. With him being able to tap into whatever it is the university had to offer.
Through the years, did Julius embrace what he meant to the university as far as its integration of the football program?
I don't know that that was a heavy thought for him. I think he knew the power that or the strength of what he was doing would do for those behind him, because Julius became an advocate for the football program and African-Americans coming to it, and was very instrumental in the recruiting effort to get them there. If you talk to a number of those young boys that came behind him, they'll indicate, you know, Julius recruited me, Earl Campbell, Leeks, Ivy Suber. You know, there's just a number of them that Julius helped recruit to come to the football program.
Once Julius got into the professional world, how do you think that he used that particular position he had within the university community to help him professionally?
I think, and I'm not sure, we never had this conversation, but I think whatever Julius got from UT was just part of his MO, because Julius was very curious. He loved to read. He loved to know about any and everything. He had a tremendous collection of books. And although he did travel himself, he used his books as educational material and also a way to travel. So he just, I mean, Julius was different in that he didn't look at the university as giving him something as much as the university existed. It had resources, and he attempted to tap into those resources.
Did you attend any of his games?
No, because I was in college in Georgia. So, no, I didn't.
Did your parents try to attend most of his games?
I know my mom and my dad, maybe a couple, but I know my mom was pretty good about going to his games.
Of the awards that Julius has been the recipient of, what do you think he would have been most proud of?
Oh, gosh. It's hard.
Okay.
That's hard because he loved every entity that recognized Julius. Julius had an affinity for. So I can't say one was stronger than the other, although football might have been it. The Hall of Honor might have been the one. And then again, recently, the San Antonio. Of curiosity, of using those resources that are at your hand to your advantage and appreciate the environment you're in and take advantage of that environment.
Is there any recognition of Julius at Highland High School?
None other than the Sports Hall of Fame, no.
You think it should be?
Not necessarily.
Okay. Okay.
Not necessarily, because the environment at that high school has changed.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So I think, you know, the awards and recognition that he's gotten is said a lot. Because actually, even with the San Antonio Sports Hall of Fame, that touches on his high school years.
Looking back on Julius' career as a sister, what are you most proud of your brother?
That, number one, he was my brother. He was my buddy. He was my pal. He was my confidant. He was my advisor. He as much as we fought as children, I recognized that my brother was brilliant and he was an amazing guy. And that's what I miss. I don't have that extension of me to call on anymore. And he was a great support.
I don't know if you can answer this question, but I'm going to ask anyway. Do you think this generation of student-athletes, not particularly here at the university, but probably globally, understand the significance that Julius has had on the sport and athletics in general?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so, because Julius, what he did, I guess, is a microcosm of what has been going on in the world, and I don't know that it touched broader enough to impact other folks. Here in Texas, perhaps, but more broadly than that, I don't think so, because it wasn't given the kind of attention that would bring notice to the significance of it.
Mildred Whittier, the sister of the late Julius Whittier. Julius died on September 24, 2018. He was 68. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future in Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production.
It's a Sunday morning, and you're listening to the Jazz Corner here on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Kevin Amos. Thank you.
Thank you.